From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This is Woodward. I want to talk about Watergate. I know
we're not going to talk about that subject.
Well, we talked about Wallace.
But this is different.
That was about the shooting of a man running for president.
This is different.
How?
Not about this story. Don't call me again.
Who was Deep Throat?
There was a list that I happened to see on TV. It was the 10 greatest mysteries of the 20th century. And number five was Deep Throat. Number one was the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. You know, there's a difference there. With Amelia Earhart, nobody knows what happened. But with Deep Throat, people know, but they're not telling us.
A University of Illinois professor and his class say they've uncovered the identity of Deep Throat. We'll find out who they believe exposed the story behind the break-in of Watergate, one of the largest political scandals in the nation's history. The FBI has admitted it secretly confiscated a package that was being sent from one AP reporter to another. The FBI opened an investigation, but journalism experts claim it has greatly overstepped its bounds and has infringed on the free speech of the press. We'll go to Iraq to look at one of the many untold stories of the recent invasion, a U.S. bombing in late March that hit a family farmhouse, killing three. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Former Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz has turned himself in to U.S. forces. Aziz gave himself up in Baghdad after discussions with U.S. forces through an intermediary, this according to the London Guardian. Intelligence experts say Aziz is unlikely to possess information about weapons of mass destruction or Saddam's current whereabouts. He was the only Christian in the former Iraqi government and not a member of Saddam's hand-picked Tikrit clan. He never wielded power and was just number 43 on the list of 55 most wanted Iraqis. But the fact that he is alive suggests that Saddam Hussein and his son may also still be alive. The Guardian reports Aziz may possess explosive information on the extent of the West's past support for Saddam Hussein. He was appointed foreign minister in 1983 and was largely credited with securing Western support for Iraq against Iran. Aziz became prominent in 1991 following Iraq's invasion of Kuwait when he led talks in various countries trying to avert war. Several months ago, Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill interviewed Tariq Aziz.
All the pretexts which are being used against Iraq and the leadership of Iraq are false pretexts. The issue, as it was said, is oil. The issue is to impose American imperialistic control on Iraq.
Tariq Aziz, we have more on his surrender in the other hour of the expanded Democracy Now! Key oil exporting countries agreed today to cut crude oil exports by 2 million barrels per day starting in June to try to stem a fall in prices and make way for the expected resumption of Iraqi exports this summer. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries made the decision at its meeting in Vienna today. Iraq did not attend the meeting for the first time since OPEC was founded in Baghdad in 1960. Its former oil minister is on the list of Iraqi officials most wanted by the United States. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal is reporting the U.S. government is setting up Iraq's oil industry to run like an American corporation, with a chief executive and management team vetted by U.S. officials who would answer to a multinational board of advisors. The advisory board will be chaired by Philip Carroll, the former chief executive of Shell Oil. Carroll will represent Iraq at future OPEC meetings. Fadil Othman is expected to be named the Iraqi vice chair. He worked as an Iraqi oil executive before Saddam Hussein came to power. The interim management team will be composed of current and former Iraqi oil sector officials. Newly appointed executives will answer to the advisory board, which in turn will answer to General Jay Garner, the new U.S. ruler of Iraq. U.S. Marines have begun patrolling stretches of the Iraqi border with Iran to screen border traffic for so-called hostile infiltrators. The operation began amid concern in Washington that Iranians may be entering the country to stir up anti-American sentiment among fellow Iraqi Shia. U.S. Central Command said the Marine Border Patrols will search, review, interview, and possibly detain all people attempting to enter and leave Iraq through Iran. Meanwhile, Reuters is reporting the U.S. may use Iran's main rebel group, the Iraq-based People's Mujahideen, to pressure Tehran as tensions rise between the two countries over post-Saddam Iraq. For years, Washington shunned the heavily armed group as a terrorist organization. The left-leaning group broke with the ruling clergy after the 1979 revolution against the U.S.-backed Shah and waged a bloody campaign in the early 1980s with a wave of assassinations of top officials. According to the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, some members of Congress now see the Mujahideen as the best thing since sliced bread. The British Defense Ministry said yesterday soldiers returning from the Gulf will be offered tests to check levels of depleted uranium in their bodies. The tests will assess whether they're in danger of suffering kidney damage and lung cancer as a result of exposure to the U.S. and British munitions. The ministry was responding to a warning earlier in the day from Britain's premier scientific body, the Royal Society, that soldiers and civilians might be exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. The warning challenged earlier reassurances from the British Defense Secretary that depleted uranium is not a risk. This news from Pennsylvania, a 14-year-old boy armed with three handguns shot and killed his junior high school principal before fatally shooting himself in the head. James Robert Sheets was an eighth grade student at Red Lion Area Junior High School, located in a quiet community north of Baltimore. School and police officials described Sheets as a nice average kid who had no known history of trouble with the principal or anyone else. The first face-to-face talks between North Korea and the U.S. on North Korea's nuclear program have ended badly a day earlier than planned. U.S. officials said Pyongyang admitted it had nuclear weapons. When President Bush heard this, he accused North Korea of using blackmail. North Korea says it put forward a bold proposal, but said the U.S. merely repeated its demand that North Korea scrap its nuclear program before further dialogue. Secretary of State General Colin Powell said, quote, strong views were expressed, which the BBC says is a diplomatic euphemism for a major argument. Chinese officials sealed off a second major hospital today, and the government was forced to deny martial law is imminent as roadblocks were thrown up around Beijing to combat SARS. The Ditan Hospital is treating more than 100 SARS patients. 600 medical staff were told they can't go home. This after China yesterday quarantined thousands of Beijing residents who've had contact with suspected carriers of the deadly virus. Isolation orders were imposed on homes, factories, and schools, and residents are being monitored to ensure that they don't flee. An official circular from the Beijing municipal government, meanwhile, said all college students and teachers are, quote, prohibited from leaving the capital for the May Day holidays. At Beijing's railway stations, throngs of people are trying to escape despite inflated ticket prices. China announced another five deaths and nearly 200 new cases. China's SARS death toll is now at 115. Meanwhile, two people have died from SARS in the Philippines. All of this comes as health advocates are trying to draw attention to malaria today on Africa Malaria Day. Malaria is far more deadly than SARS. The World Health Organization and the United Nations Children's Fund published report that some 3,000 African children die every day of the disease. 1 million people die every year. But malaria generally strikes only impoverished people in the global south, whereas SARS appears to cross both class and country lines, with Toronto, Canada, under a WHO travel advisory. The WHO is calling for the most malaria-effective drugs to be made more widely available. Even insecticide-treated mosquito nets could reduce malaria transmission up to 60%. Attorney General John Ashcroft has ruled that broad categories of foreigners who arrive in the U.S. illegally can be detained indefinitely without consideration of their individual circumstances if immigration officials say their release would endanger national security. Ashcroft released the far-reaching decision yesterday in denying bond to an 18-year-old Haitian who landed in Florida with more than 200 other refugees. The Washington Post reports the ruling means that groups of asylum seekers can be locked up without hearings and without resource to release on bond. Immigration advocates denounced the ruling. The executive director of the Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center, Cheryl Little, said, quote, "You'd think the attorney general would have better things to do these days than target an innocent Haitian asylum seeker." She also said detentions of an earlier boatload of Haitians had cost the government $12.5 million over a six-month period. Today is the deadline for male immigrants from Egypt, Kuwait, Jordan, Indonesia, and Bangladesh to register with the U.S. government. Immigrants who report to authorities are photographed, fingerprinted, questioned, and in some cases detained and deported. During the last 5 months, nearly 130,000 male immigrants and visitors, predominantly Muslim, have been questioned in immigration offices, airports, and border crossings. A UN vote on gay rights was derailed yesterday at the last minute by an alliance of Muslim countries. The UN had been due to vote on the matter for the first time in its almost 60-year history, but five Muslim countries delayed the vote until today and introduced amendments that remove all references to discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and render the resolution meaningless. UN sources told The Guardian that major U.S. allies, Pakistan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, as well as Libya and Malaysia, were doing everything they could to stop the resolution. And finally, Winnie Mandela, South Africa's former first lady and heroine of the struggle against apartheid, faces a maximum sentence of 15 years in prison after being found guilty yesterday on 43 charges of fraud and 25 of theft. She is expected to be sentenced today. She pleaded not guilty.
As I raise my hand to broadcast my objection to latest triumph draws the final straw. Who died and lifted you up to perfection? Silence me is written into law. I can't believe where circumstances thrown me, and I turn my head away. If I look, I'm not sure that I could face you. Not again. Not today. Not today.
The Final Straw, R.E.M., here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last September, a reporter with the Associated Press in the Philippines sent a FedEx package to a colleague in Washington. The package contained unclassified FBI documents. Reporters send such items often, but this one never made it to Washington. FedEx officials originally said the package may have fallen off its delivery van, but AP officials were suspicious of what happened. And now it turns out the package was never lost. It was seized and confiscated by the FBI. In an April 3rd letter released this week, the FBI acknowledged that its agents had confiscated the package at Customs. Unnamed FBI officials told the New York Times the documents seized were too sensitive for public consumption. The package contained a report with detailed materials seized from the apartment of a man convicted in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. The FBI also announced this week it had opened an internal investigation to determine whether its agents abused their authority by secretly seizing the documents. We go now to Lucy Dalglish. She is executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk about this case and what this means for journalism?
Well, you know, journalists, as you mentioned a moment ago, journalists use this type of information all the time, and they are sending it back and forth to each other. And I think an important thing to add to your description of this case is that these records, not only were they unclassified, but they had been entered into evidence in two trials, including the 1993 World Trade Center bombing trial. And they were introduced in open court. They were public records. And anyone who wanted to go to the court and spend the money and wait for them to make duplicates would have been entitled to get these records. It just so happened that someone at the AP in the Philippines had the records and said, no, you know, don't go to the court. I'll just overnight them to you. It'll be faster. It'll be easier. It'll be cheaper. So this is the type of thing that journalists always worry about, particularly in times like these, when it seems as though the government is trying to, you know, if perhaps with good motives, the government is trying to really restrict the flow of information to the public.
How did the FBI know that the reporter in the Philippines was sending this?
Oh, it was a very typical thing. When you send a Federal Express package from overseas, it goes to a centralized processing facility. In this case, it was Indianapolis. And every time you send anybody sends a package, Customs has the right to open anything, and they do a random check. Now, I believe Customs probably was just doing a routine check. Now, we know that it had to have gotten to the country because at the same time, an identical package was being sent from the Philippines to New York. The New York package made it. The Washington, D.C. package did not. So Customs opens it, sees that these are FBI documents, calls the FBI and says, hey, you know, maybe you want to look at this. And the FBI came and looked at it, and instead of getting a warrant and going through the motions of doing, you know, if they had a concern, there is a legal process for how they can detain this package. Instead, they just took it.
Now, the AP reporter, John Solomon, mm-hmm. was the same reporter whose home phone records were subpoenaed by the Justice Department in 2001 to try to determine the source of leaks and articles he had written about an investigation into Senator Robert Torricelli of New Jersey. Is that right?
That's true.
John Solomon has been under a lot of scrutiny, it looks like.
I don't think any FBI agent in Indianapolis would have had a clue who John Solomon is. And I've talked to John about this, and he doesn't think that the package was seized because his name was on it. He thinks it was seized because of what was inside it. Now, John Solomon is one heck of an aggressive reporter. And if they're keeping an eye on him, that wouldn't surprise me much. But he believes this particular incident with the FedEx package was fairly random. I don't know if that's what he thinks about the Torricelli thing.
In looking at the New York Times piece about this, it quotes an FBI official defending the Bureau's handling of the confiscating of the FedEx packet. It says, this was an internal FBI document. It was not something that was supposed to be released publicly. It's taking something from an FBI file and handing it to someone. This document was not the property of the Associated Press. That's the rub, he said.
No, that's just completely false. As I said, these documents had been introduced into a public trial. They then become public documents, public records. And anybody, your mother could go off tomorrow and ask for those documents and get them. They are unclassified. Now, they contained a lot of information about the materials used in some bombings, but they were not sealed in court. And the jury and anyone who was watching that trial would have seen these documents.
So what about FedEx and all of this? At first they thought FedEx said that it dropped off their truck, but this means they too are cooperating with the FBI, and are they handing over documents when they don't have subpoenas?
Well, I'm not quite sure exactly how this works, so I'm not, likely to, I'm not going to point the finger at FedEx at this point, but there, like I said, there's a process where every FedEx package coming in from overseas goes through customs. I think FedEx probably had a duty to keep track of its packages, and when the AP, followed up and said, "Hey, we're missing something," I think they had a duty to, track it down, figure out exactly what happened. But I don't know what the process is within customs as to how much knowledge they would have had about what actually happened to that package.
So what is the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press calling for?
I'm sorry?
What is your committee calling for, the Reporters Committee for
Freedom of the Press? Well, I applaud Senator Grassley for writing that letter and asking for the FBI investigation. That's clearly something that has to be done. And we agree with him and we're waiting to see what the FBI report comes up with. My hope is that the folks probably in the Indianapolis field office, where I think this happened, unless they called Washington and got somebody higher up to say it, I'm hoping that they face some sort of disciplinary action.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Lucy Dalglish, Executive Director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. When we come back from break, who is Deep Throat? A college professor thinks he knows. Stay with us. Music by The Dirty Three here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. It may be one of the greatest mysteries of the 20th century. Who was Deep Throat? Who was the White House insider who tipped off the Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein? Based on information from Deep Throat, they began to piece together the deep secrets of the White House. Their stories led to the demise of the Nixon presidency. For nearly three decades, the person's identity has been unknown to but a handful at the Washington Post. But now, after a four-year investigation, an University of Illinois journalism professor and his class believe they have solved the mystery. Maybe you saw all the president's men, Robert Redford playing Bob Woodward. This was one of the scenes.
I want to talk about Watergate. I know that
we're not going to talk about that subject.
Well, we talked about Wallace.
But this is different.
That was about the shooting of a man running for president.
This is different.
How?
Not about this story. Don't call me again.
The professor, who thinks he does know, is William Gaines. He joins us now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
So, who was Deep Throat?
Fred Fielding. Fred Fielding was Deep Throat. We're certain of it. We would not have gone ahead and announced that. We see, examining the records, the documents that we assembled over 4 years, that nobody else could be Deep Throat other than Mr. Fielding. He has all the qualifications, and he had access to the information that Deep Throat had. In many instances, we found that he would be the only person, the only living person, who had such access to particular bits of information that Deep Throat had. So we're certain that it's Fred Fielding. Fred Fielding was the chief deputy to John Dean at the time of Watergate, and he's an active attorney. He's very accomplished. He's very trusted. He's a recognized authority.
Professor Gaines, as you know, because you teach young people, for a lot of people, they won't even know who John Dean was. So if you can explain each step of the way and each figure in this investigation.
Well, John Dean was involved in the cover-up itself as a chief counsel to President Nixon, the cover-up of the White House involvement in the break-in of the Watergate office complex, the Democratic National Committee headquarters. So he was a part of the cover-up. He then, months later, went public and testified against Nixon. So there were many heroes of the Watergate era. John Dean was one of them. Deep Throat, Fred Fielding was another.
How did you find this out?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Can you talk about how you found this out, the process of elimination, and have you spoken to Fred Fielding himself?
I'll answer the first question, how it worked. We approached this with the idea that everybody in the world was a possible suspect as being Deep Throat, and we eliminated individuals based on information in All the President's Men, the book that Woodward and Bernstein wrote. It's a work of nonfiction, autobiographical in nature, and written by a couple of very good reporters. So we established the fact from the start that what they wrote about was true. We worked out a formula in which we eliminated individuals one by one. Over the years, Woodward and Bernstein have given us many clues as to who Deep Throat is, the fact that he's still living, that he smokes, that he drinks scotch and things like that. And so as we went down the list of individuals, we narrowed the location of Deep Throat in the White House based on access to information. And then we went through the roster of White House employees at the time, staff members, high-level officials, and we were eliminated individuals till we got down to seven. Last June, which was the 30th anniversary of Watergate, we had seven suspects, and what we did then was concentrate on them. It could be no one else. We eliminated individuals if we could find they were somewhere else at the time when Woodward and Bernstein were meeting, or rather Woodward was meeting with Deep Throat in the garage. And finally, we did concentrate on a few individuals, and then from records that we assembled over 4 years, we pulled together. It was one of those things, like I think in an investigation, suddenly it just all comes together. And the students and I discussed it, we worked on it, and we saw that Fred Fielding was the only individual who fit the description of Deep Throat and had access to that information. We have contacted him. We tried several times to reach him by phone, by email. About 2 weeks ago, we sent him a letter, an overnight letter, and got a receipt back that he had received it. And in that letter, we stated exactly the information that we had, so he would know what we were going to be saying in our report, so he'd have a chance to respond. he hasn't responded to us, and I don't believe that he's responded to any of the news media, as far as I know.
We're talking to Professor William Gaines, University of Illinois professor, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the Chicago Tribune. What role did your students play? This was a four-year investigation.
Yes, it was 4 years. Of course, the students changed every semester. There were eight semesters of students, and so it was pretty difficult. We started out from scratch, not knowing too much. Each time we would be on a roll, you know, the students understanding what to pursue, why they'd be gone and they'd be a new class, I'd have to get them up to speed. And then the amount of information accumulated to the degree that it would be half a semester would be gone before I could explain what we had. But it all came together in the last two semesters. The students had studied 16,000 pages of FBI reports that we got. We studied the testimony from the Watergate hearings. We looked at transcripts of civil suits. We read the books that participants in Watergate had written. It just seemed like everybody wrote a book, and that was pretty good for us, you know, because it was just, even though many of those persons like Haldeman and Ehrlichman, the top assistants to Nixon, had died, it was just like we were able to get an interview with them, because they told us in their first-person account books what happened as far as they were concerned. So with all that information, the students were kept busy. Another thing we did was we created a database. We used an Excel spreadsheet, and it was a simple database. We kept a chronology of events in that, and the students would take a floppy disk around with them. They'd go to the library and do research, and most of the information we had, of course, was it was public record or it was published information, and a lot of it came from the library. And they would gather information, they'd put it on the floppy disk, and we would combine it with the main program. And it was a searchable, sortable database. Didn't tell us who Deep Throat was, but it was a good way to keep our statistics and our facts organized.
Professor William Gaines is our guest from the University of Illinois. Urbana-Champaign says he solved the Deep Throat riddle, that it is Fred Fielding, who was the attorney for John Dean. Now, can you take us through the Watergate break-in and how he would know what he knew, when it was, and why it was so significant?
Well, one of the aspects of the Watergate break-in, you know, Howard Hunt was a supervisor of the burglars, and Howard Hunt was a consultant to the White House. He was on the White House payroll. He had an office in the White House, and he had a safe in the White House. The first day, the Monday morning after the Saturday break-in, Fred Fielding was asked by John Dean to open Howard Hunt's safe and inventory what was in there. And when he did that, he found that there were embarrassing files that Hunt had. Hunt was using his White House office for espionage against the political opponents of the Nixon administration. And so Fred Fielding was the first person to see those documents. And then also he was in the White House. He was present at the time, or was told by John Dean about specific conversations that took place that day and during the next week that Deep Throat knew about. Very few people knew about the situation. Also, Fred Fielding was able to read FBI reports that were shipped over from the FBI to John Dean. It was an unusual circumstance. The FBI is investigating people in the White House, and meanwhile, John Dean was getting all their reports. John Dean had gone to the acting director of the FBI, L. Patrick Gray, and asked for the reports. And Gray told him that he can't give them out. They're confidential FBI reports. But Dean said, well, I'm the chief counsel for President Nixon, and the president wants them. And so Gray said, well, okay, if that's the case, I guess you could have them. And they were shipped over. They were picked up by Fielding, and in some instances he testified that he read them. Information from those FBI reports was very closely held, and it was exclusive information that, that Deep Throat had. So we traced many instances of facts that were passed along by Deep Throat to Woodward, to Fred Fielding.
So you tried to get Fred Fielding's response. You know he received your investigation and your conclusion that Deep Throat is Fred Fielding. He hasn't responded. What about Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, the Washington Post reporters? Have you talked to them?
We attempted early on to talk to Bob Woodward, and he declined to talk to us. He said that he wouldn't discuss a subject that a good reporter protects his sources. With Carl Bernstein, it was a little different. One of the students called him, and he became very irate when he was told about our project. And he said that he didn't respect our project, that he thought it was wrong for us to be revealing another reporter's source. It was not a good thing to be teaching journalists to do. Well, I myself don't see it quite that way. I agree that a reporter does not reveal his or her source. Definitely, you just don't do it. What they have done, though, is actually reveal the source by making a movie character out of him. I tell my students, if you have a source, you don't say anything. What they have done is make a movie character. They have given us hints as to who their source was and how they met and what the source said, and actually described him physically. So it's become more of a game. And I at the turn of the century, I saw a list of the top mysteries of the 20th century, and Deep Throat was number five. The disappearance of Amelia Earhart was number one. And there's a difference with the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. Nobody knows what happened to her. But with Deep Throat, somebody knows, and they're not telling us. So that was a challenge to us, and that's how we replied to Bernstein's complaint. But both Woodward and Bernstein have not commented on our findings. However, the fact that Bernstein was pretty much upset by the fact that we're doing it gave us more confidence that we are correct.
We're talking tonight, Professor Bill Gaines, an investigative reporter with the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Let's talk about Fred Fielding today. Going back a little in time, you have a piece, Who is Deep Throat? It starts, I'm in charge here. Then Secretary of State Alexander Haig told the press as President Reagan was undergoing surgery in 1981 to remove the bullet of a would-be assassin. But Haig had misstated the laws of presidential succession. Someone would have to set him straight. No, Al, Fred Fielding told Haig as he left the press conference. Fielding is among the most respected legal minds in government. Deputy assistant to President Nixon, chief counsel to Reagan for 5 years, a member of the Bush-Cheney transition team, and today a member of the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks, all the while quietly issuing legal opinions away from the center stage. Fred Fielding today continues to be a player in Washington.
Yes, he's very important. He's on the 10-member 9/11 commission, and the other members are former senators and former governors. So you can see the stature that that he has to receive an appointment of that type.
What project are you working on next, Professor Gaines? What source has to cover his or her trail very carefully now?
Well, I don't know that we will work on the same type of a story again. This was never a planned project of a great research by the university. It was just a classroom exercise. It grew and grew because people were interested in it. And so we didn't plan it. The next time when we do something, we will plan what we're going to do in advance, and we've gotten a lot of suggestions, and I'm certainly open for more. I would like to do something that has a little more social significance. You can say, okay, what's it all mean? And the reason that we continued to pursue it until the very end was that people asked us to do that. There was so much great interest in it that nobody else could take on the job. Newspapers were not going to investigate another newspaper, and there wouldn't be no government investigation of this type of a story. So it was left to some independent entity like an investigative reporting class at the university to do something like this. So we're open for ideas, and we don't have anything specific, but we would probably want to do something that has a lot of social significance and is going to resolve some issue that has been a question for a long while.
Professor William Gaines, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter with the Chicago Tribune, Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Iraq to break a story about a family that had taken refuge in a home and was bombed during the U.S. invasion. Stay with us.
The pledge to resist. We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our name.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A month ago, an Iraqi farmhouse was hit by a U.S. missile. Three members of the family that was taking refuge inside were killed. They were among the unknown number of civilians who've died during the U.S. invasion. The website IraqBodyCount.net estimates that as many as 2,380 Iraqi civilians have been killed. The numbers could be far higher. Well, today we're going to start off with a report by freelance journalist Julia Guest, who went to the farmhouse that was bombed.
Dalia, a beautiful fruit-growing region outside Baghdad, was considered a safe area by the Al-Jaburis and many other Iraqi families seeking a place to survive the war. 17-year-old Ahmed had been standing in the field.
The plane passed overhead and fired a rocket.
On March 24th at 4 p.m., three young people were killed as a rocket hit their uncle's farmhouse. The first floor of their home was demolished in the attack. Three families of the Al-Jaburi family had shared this farmhouse. They had prepared everything for the coming months. Food rations were stored. They had a cow and chickens and local farm produce. This would have meant an easier life than staying in the center of Baghdad. I met their neighbors who explained what they had seen and had happened to their houses.
What we saw was the plane firing three rockets. One rocket hit the house, and two fell at a distance.
البيوت المجاورة ها
The houses nearby, all of them were destroyed, even TV sets as a result of the force of the blast. We even have children whose eardrums popped from the force of the blast.
I met the family in the Yarmouk hospital in Baghdad just hours after the attack. 9-year-old Rana suffered concussion and chest, lung and arm injuries. Only found out his young wife Nada was buried under the rubble when he reached the hospital. Asma's 8-year-old daughter Zara died in her arms. 4-year-old Mohammed's face was covered in shrapnel wounds.
They hate this child. What could this child do against the Americans? He only likes to play. Now they have deprived him.
Why?
Give me one reason, one convincing reason for all this.
You talk of peace, of the doves of peace, but they're gone.
A 14-year-old Nada sustained leg and skull injuries. Omar and Nada were married just a week, and she was buried with her sister-in-law and cousin the day after the bombing. The family and neighbors insisted no military targets were nearby, and no one could understand why this had happened.
And that report by freelance reporter Julia Guest, who joins us on the line right now. She's recently come out of Iraq and is now in London. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Julia.
Hi, Amy.
Can you talk about how you discovered this family and the story of the U.S. missile that hit their home?
Sure. We were actually taken to one of the hospitals on a sort of fairly routine hospital visit, and the family were just brought into the casualty unit as we were there, and we saw the state of their injuries and the extent of the damage done to them. I asked to be taken to the farmhouse, which they had to seek permission for, as it was quite a way outside Baghdad, but we got that the next day and were taken straight there.
Who is we? And then how did you track down this story?
Okay. I was with the Iraq peace team, who were taking some witness reports for potentially bringing court cases against the U.S. and the British government for war crimes against civilians. And we were taken there by some of the Iraqi guides who were working with us. The case against for this family is pretty clear cut. There was very clearly no reason for them to be bombed, and it seems that it was almost a vindictive bombing. I mean, there was no air defense battery in that region. There's certainly no way that it could have been anti-aircraft. There were rockets that were fired straight through the roof. And I'm now very concerned that not only should their case be brought, but also that some compensation should be taken back to Iraq and to at least give them some small chance. I mean, they've now lost their home, relatives. Some of them were severely injured. I think it's the absolute minimum that could happen at this stage.
Now, Julia, you originally pitched this story to the BBC, who you have worked for before. What happened?
Yeah. Well, they initially, I transmitted the video to them, and they decided on the basis of the quality of the resolution was too low, which I found a bit odd. And then I brought the tapes back to London, and they presented it to a program, an 8 o'clock roundup of reports from Iraq. And they decided it was too early to show this kind of program, and they quite literally turned around and said, well, we think it's just too strong that and it made me question about how much it's possible to personalize stories.
They said they think it's too strong.
Yeah.
Meaning?
Well, it was a very personal account. It named names. It showed people's injuries. It made connections with the family. And I know a lot of the reporting has been quite depersonalized. I think generally there's a tendency for a lot of the footage that has come out of Iraq has been very, very totally detached from individual people. When corporations are spending £1 million to put a camera on a tank, and yet don't want to run just ordinary civilian diaries or stories, then you just question what's happening in the media across the board.
It's interesting, Julia. This report just came out in The Independent. The director general of the BBC attacked U.S. television and radio networks for their, quote, shocking and gung-ho coverage of the invasion of Iraq. Greg Dyke warned against new British government proposals that would allow U.S. media corporations to take a greater share of British television and radio. He said they could lead to a loss of impartiality in news coverage. In his first public comment since the war, Dyke said, quote, the U.S. has no news operation strong enough or brave enough to stand up to the White House and Pentagon.
Uh-huh. Well, that's certainly, I didn't obviously see a lot of the American coverage. What little I did see, things like the image on the back of a tank, utterly pointless. They don't convey information. It's just a static image. I think to their credit, the BBC were one of the few corporations that remained inside Baghdad when every other major channel left. That they weren't prepared to go a step further and start including more personalised reports, I think, was a great shame. I'm sure that, if they're... in the long term, they may be able to do it at more of a distance, but I think there is quite clearly lines are drawn about how far they can personalize a story during a war.
What are your plans now? And by the way, once again, you said that this farmhouse had no military installations nearby?
None whatsoever. And all the local people were quite adamant about that. They were absolutely insisting that there was nothing around whatsoever. I certainly couldn't see anything. It was a very peaceful fruit-growing district. There would have been no reason to defend it. There would be no obvious target there. And I know that in the past, certainly, that bombing in the no-fly zone has seen this happen before. And hundreds and hundreds of families went to these farmhouses around the suburbs of Baghdad to be safe from the bombing. So they clearly also believed there was no danger. My plans now are to go back to Iraq, and any money I can raise for this family, I will take to them if I can find them somewhere. I have as many dresses as I could gather from them before we left them. I'm also planning to go and work with a group of students who want to start their own indie media site, and I think this is incredibly important that some people in Iraq now have the opportunity at least to start expressing what they feel. Certainly the whole time I was there, if the consistent comment was that nobody wanted to have a war, not for any reason, varying sort of opinions on their own internal politics, but that was fairly consistently something for them to resolve. So I think it's incredibly important now that the Iraqi people get a chance to get a say and to be listened to. So I'm going to head back out there and offer what support I can to this project. And also I hope to make a film with them about their work in realizing this, and I hope that could be something that a Western audience could appreciate, and that it would be something for the long-term recovery in Iraq, because I think very clearly the breakdown in communication has sort of with individual people sort of understanding each other and as a whole country, it's absolutely vital.
Well, Julia Guest, I want to thank you very much for bringing us this story. Julia Guest, an independent reporter. She was in Iraq, now in Britain, heads back to Iraq soon. And we hope to follow up with you when you return to Iraq to visit the survivors of this family. It so much reminds me of Masuda Sultan, a story we've continued to cover, a young Afghan-American woman who went back to her family in Kandahar. They had left Kandahar and traveled miles outside to a farmhouse to be safe from the U.S. bombing. It was there that their farmhouse was bombed by U.S. planes, and she lost, I believe, 18 members of her family. Julia Guest, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You are listening to Democracy Now! In the last few minutes of the program that we have left, we go to Ali Abu Nima, who runs the electronic intifada.net website. And Ali has found and posted just this morning secret documents from the Luntz Research Companies that outline Israel's public relations to sway public opinion in this country. Can you lay out, Ali, what you have posted?
Yes, it's at electronicintifada.net. This is a document prepared for pro-Israel activists and the Israeli government by the Luntz Research Companies and the Israel Project, which is a pro-Israel coalition in this country. It's incredible stuff. What it does is it counsels pro-Israel advocates on how to build support for Israel's hardline policies. It tells them to keep invoking the name of Saddam Hussein and to stress that Israel was always behind American efforts to rid the world of this ruthless dictator. Despite his solid support for Israel and Ariel Sharon, it warns Israel not to compliment or praise President Bush because that could alienate democratic supporters of Israel. And at the same time, it acknowledges that Yasser Arafat has been a great asset to Israel because he looks the part of the terrorist. Let me read you one bit, which I think is particularly telling. It says, and I quote, "To some extent, your job as proponents of Israel has been easy. Under the Arafat regime, it's not difficult to convince the American public of the corruption of the current Palestinian leadership. While many sympathize with the plight of the Palestinian people, there is no love lost for Yasser Arafat. Arafat is a terrorist, they know that. Better still, he looks the part. The emergence of Mahmoud Abbas as the new Palestinian prime minister comes at exactly the wrong time. His ascent to power seems legitimate. He's a fresh face and a clean-shaven one at that. He speaks well and dresses in Western garb. He may even genuinely want peace. Just as President Bush had begun to make headway in drawing attention on the need for a reformed Palestinian leadership, the Palestinians throw us this curveball." So this document is suffused with cynicism, with an attempt to manipulate U.S. public opinion, an attempt to exploit the war with Iraq in order to preserve the status quo in Israel. It's really incredible stuff, and the reason we've published it is because we think there's a major public interest in knowing the way the pro-Israel lobby is trying to manipulate the United States into maintaining support for Sharon's government.
Ali Abu Nima, thank you for being with us, founder of electronicintifada.net. And this this document from the Luntz Company is on electronicintifada.net. Thank you very much for being with us. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Berkenji, Karen Sharif, Abdul Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Vilka Tsouris. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. A very special thanks to Angela Alston. If you want a copy of today's show, 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.